Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Linarduzzi, an editor at the TLS, and Lucy Dallas, our arts editor, is here with me too. Hello, Lucy. How are you?
I'm fine, Thea. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. I'm okay. I was struck flicking through the paper this week by the headline of one of your arts pieces, Lucy, and it goes, "Wrong-footed by events, Shakespeare's lovely bully in the unpredictable present." Do you want to tell us a bit about that one?
Yes, it's really interesting, actually. So it's Professor Emma Smith, who I think we've talked to on the podcast before.
We have. She's always brilliant.
Yeah, yeah. And she's done this terrific review of a new production of Henry V at the Donmar Warehouse with Kit Harington, or for Game of Thrones fans, Jon Snow, I think he is.
I'm
taking this as read because I haven't seen it.
No, me neither.
He's Henry V. And it's wrong-footed by events. First of all, if you're a proper Shakespearean, you will know that Henry V, the play itself, was slightly wrong-footed by events, something to do with the Earl of Essex. I'm not really, you know, competent to go into those matters.
Well, that's why we get Emma Smith to write the review.
But this production, she said, was conceived. I think it's been in the works for a while, and is conceived as a meditation on patriotism in terms of sort of little Englandism, and thinking about things like Brexit and Extinction Rebellion and the EU and, you know, that kind of thing. And what does patriotism mean? The St. George's flags, all of that sort of thing. But it's the press night had been put off, I think, by the pandemic, but also this time had been put off by COVID as well. And so it's quite a military themed production. I mean, Henry V is anyway, but this one is particularly, there's a lot of people in military dress and, you know, that kind of thing. And by the time they opened, there was, Russia had invaded Ukraine. So suddenly, if you're doing a production about war and military dress and all that kind of thing, it seems to mean something completely different. And patriotism, do you know what I mean? Nobody's thinking about patriotism in terms of Brexit or anything anymore. The focus has completely changed, and everybody's the context in which this is being presented has completely changed, which of course they couldn't possibly have known.
That must make it very, very hard to make sure that you, or, you know, to attempt to strike the notes that you had wanted to. Emma Smith says, suddenly patriotism was all the rage, resonating less with the little Englandism of Brexit and more with the national pride and urban guerrilla mobilisation of Ukraine. And for there to be such a change of mood, it must feel to the people who are putting on the production a bit like the carpet's been pulled out from underneath them.
Yeah, I think it has. And it's also, I mean, the play itself has got a lot of changes of mood. Sometimes it's kind of rather gung-ho, and sometimes it's the pity of war. But in general, it's a bit more gung-ho than the other, which is a very uncomfortable note to strike at the moment. And it's fascinating how the context can change. I mean, the point is, this has been, you know, going on. Mm-hmm. This has been going on for hundreds of years with Shakespeare, but it's it's fascinating how the context can change the resonances and how people think about things. So very much worth a read.
Yeah. And I mean, the war in Ukraine's had a similar sharpening effect on the books reviewed by Eric Rauchway this week as well. He reviews three books, Butler to the World, How Britain Became the Servant of Tycoons, Tax Dodgers, Kleptocrats and Criminals, by Oliver Bolo. American Kleptocracy, which is by Casey Michelle, and that the subtitle of that one is How the US Created the Greatest Money Laundering Scheme in History. And finally, Uncommon Wealth, Britain and the Aftermath of Empire, by Kojo Karam. And these, you know, these are books about how the cost of allowing ill-gotten or dirty money to circulate in the heart of our economies is staggering and is difficult to deny in all sorts of ways. You know, Rauchway makes a vivid analogy at the start, doesn't he?
Yes, he compares it to the pirates, isn't it? And there's an area where the pirates are basically not outlawed, so they continue to, frankly, do whatever they want. And the interesting thing about his thrust of the point is that the thinking was that the sort of respectable rest of the world will influence the unrespectable shady corners and it will all become above board. But in fact, he says the opposite is what happens. In fact, the piracy then goes back to the heart of the metropolis because it's allowed to operate and thrive. And again, you're right, the context of that has changed pretty quickly in the past few weeks, isn't it?
And I mean, the pirate problem of the 1600s, the refrain was sort of established then, which is stopping dirty money would destroy the economy. And this would be a conundrum all too familiar to Italians, of course, that if we don't do it, someone else will. You know, can a country bear to cut something that is really profitable, so profitable, but ill-gotten, out of its runnings? I mean, you'd think that could go for stamping out the corruption too. You know, if we don't stop it, someone else will. And, you know, which side would you rather be on?
Well, yeah, except it turns out it's all been going on for rather a long time.
Yeah, so we've still not sorted it out.
Not as easy as that, yeah.
Well, look, as Rauchway points out at the end of the piece then, perhaps the revelation of corruption's reach in the UK and US will bring public opinion to bear on what happens next. And that is, after all, what happened to the pirates who once plagued the Caribbean. The publication of Charles Johnson's General History of the Pirates in 1724 helped to popularise the idea that piracy ought to be stamped out and pirates hanged. For something similar to happen today would require a revival of sovereignty coupled with international cooperation, such as has not yet been seen this century, or, he says, perhaps had not been seen until the moment one of these latter-day pirates invaded a nation bordering NATO. Quite a way on which to end the piece, I think. You'll find these pieces and plenty more in this week's issue of the TLS, of course, in print and online. But now, coming up on this week's show. A work of nonfiction by the novelist Amitav Ghosh, The Nutmeg's Curse, Parables for a Planet in Crisis, paints a compelling picture of how the spice trade prefigured today's environmental crisis. But first, Margaret Atwood has secured for herself a place that few writers could conceive of. Her work is so well known that even those who haven't read a word of it will have breathed it in one way or another, whether because the themes and ideas have so thoroughly suffused the public consciousness, think of the protesters for reproductive rights who dress in blood-red hooded robes like Atwood's handmaids, or because they've caught up through some other form, such as the many film and TV adaptations of Atwood's work. As our writer Mary Norris puts it this week, in a review of a collection of Atwood's non-fiction, Burning Questions, Essays and Occasional Pieces, the novels and short stories, like Allen Ginsberg's poetry, have become part of the atmosphere, cultural fallout. To achieve such a status, to be as prolific and successful as Atwood is, surely requires a method. Or does it? Mary Norris joins us now to tell us more. Hello, Mary, and thank you for joining us.
Hello. Well, it's a pleasure to join you.
So what do we learn then from these essays and occasional pieces about Atwood's method?
Well, I noticed right away, and I think anybody who opens the book will notice, that many of the essays have a similar beginning. Margaret Atwood has been in great demand at various conferences and things like that on all different kinds of topics, from pen conferences to conferences for people who are preserving the woods, right? So she often begins an essay. It's a talk, and she begins with addressing the people who are in the room there, in the audience. So she'll say, for instance, I think I have some examples in the piece, you know, greetings, it is a pleasure to be here with you on the occasion of, and then she'll mention the person who is being honored by this talk, Bell Van Zylen, or somebody that we perhaps don't know who is. And she might go on for a little bit to say that she knows who this person is and try to make a connection with her. But then she'll say, and now I'm going to do this. I'm going to talk about this, this, and this in this order. And she does this so often that I recognized the writing instruction that we're often given as young people in composition classes. Tell them what you're going to say, say it, and then tell them what you've said. She is just a master of that and makes it look like very good advice, I have to say.
Mm, and you give a wonderful image of her in action, saying that she narrates her work like a dressmaker with pins in her mouth, chatting while she does a fitting.
Yes, it's kind of chatty and casual, but she knows just exactly what she's doing, you know. And I began to notice, because I've been in one of her audiences, I've been in her audience a couple of times, in fact, and she's very warm. She engenders a lot of warmth among the audience. And I think that one of the ways she carries that over into the printed talks is by invoking the audience that she was speaking directly to.
Mm.
You know, it's a direct connection with the reader.
And as you say, I mean, the way she starts these talks, you know, always situating them and acknowledging the person who has invited her to speak on such and such a thing. It's another way of saying, you know, she writes on commission. That is to say, she is a consummate professional. She writes because she has been asked to write on the subject she has been asked to write on. There's no deep mystery here of creation, you know, no myth making about the writer's life.
Well, I guess not. When I was thinking about it and writing about it, of course, I got self-conscious and I realized that I'd been commissioned to write this piece. You know, so that's kind of the way I built the piece, was with that in mind, that I was imitating Margaret Atwood in a way while I was writing it.
And it's also fair to say, I think, that we don't really come to Atwood for the nonfiction. You know, so these essays and lectures and shorts and so on, they're mostly valuable, I suppose, because they return us to the fiction. Is that right?
You know, I have not read a lot of Margaret Atwood, her fiction, that is, because I'm not generally attracted to utopian, dystopian fiction. I don't like dystopian fiction at all. I really don't like dystopian reality, though.
No, welcome.
We have to admit that. Yeah. That seems to be a fact these days. The essays make it clear what a wonderful writer she is when she is on commission, you know, when she's been paid to do something. And when she is just making something up, when she's writing fiction, that is multiplied. The attraction is really multiplied. Reading the essays did make me want to go back and read the fiction.
And so, I mean, you've described her in your piece as the queen of speculative fiction, which isn't a label that will surprise anyone, because I suppose anyone who's followed her over the years knows how strongly she feels about this label. You know, this collection, for anyone who might have forgotten the precise details of the fiction, offers plenty of evidence for her being precisely that, the queen of speculative fiction. The reason is that she wants to draw a distinction between things that have already begun to exist, things that are already possible, that we already hold in our hands, and those which are pure works of imagination. So speculative fiction, you're dealing with things that are already in the realms of reality, of possibility. That's right, isn't it, Lucy? I expect this is very much your terrain.
Well, I wish I could sound expert on it, but that sounds absolutely like what I've heard her say about The Handmaid's Tale, certainly because she said that she didn't invent any of the things in it. They were all things that had happened at some point somewhere. Mm. It's just that she might amplify them or, you know, change them somehow or enlarge them. But yes, I think in science fiction, you can, I mean, there's people do it much, much less nowadays, but you can just say, and then they got in the, there's a generic word for the machine. It's something like the Zografire, you know, and then they got in the Zografire and it's, yeah. And it transmogrified them. So that's not what she does.
No. I suppose there's a shining example of that in Oryx and Crake. So I read that when it came out, which was 2003. And my memory of it was a little bit hazy. So I kind of reminded myself of it this weekend. And I'd forgotten quite how prescient it was. It's kind of remarkable, the stuff that she captures there. There's, you know, multiplayer games. There's one called Extinctathon. Porn saturation, bioengineering, pandemics, population politics, the state of universities and humanities and teaching in particular. And Mary, does she reflect on the life that her fiction has taken on, this kind of the life of its own that it's taken on, and what it's been able to tell us about the world in which we live?
She certainly does. And those are some of the best essays in this collection, I think. She has one on the writing of the Testaments, one on the writing of The Handmaid's Tale. And there's background on the one you just mentioned. And I love that stuff. I love reading about what inspired her to write these things and how long it took. And then, you know, the fact that the reality has caught up to them is quite terrifying. I think that Margaret Atwood is an inveterate reader of pieces on science, popular science, in the things that make it into the newspaper. And I think she also may read some professional journals, because she's been onto things a lot sooner than the general public has, you know, this idea of raising little piggies in order to give them organs that will match the humans. It's just this is of course, human life is precious and good for those people who have pig livers and kidneys and things, but I always think about the animals themselves, and I think Margaret Atwood does too. The little farms where they're making, or laboratories, I guess they are, where they're raising sacrificial pigs. You know, I think it's so sad.
She's clearly a very sensitive being, I suppose, a part of the world in which she lives. She observes, and she sometimes amplifies or often amplifies, as we said, things that are already within the bounds of possibility. The Handmaid's Tale is probably the most famous example of that. You make the very bold confession, I think, that you haven't read it, and you don't have any desire to, do you? Because presumably you feel you know it so well, so intimately already, because it has been so absorbed into the culture.
Yes, I think now I might read it just to see how she does it. You know, it's a story that, of course, gives everyone the chills, or at least it gives women the chills. And I now have seen a movie version of it, so I know how it ends and how it begins. But I would actually like to look at the prose, I confess. I would like to look back at that, see how she did it.
Mm.
You know?
Mm. You point out that, and I had no idea about this, and it's really interesting. It's made me want to go and find it, but that it was reviewed in when it came out in 1985 in the New York Times by Mary McCarthy.
Right. Oh, that could have been such a career boost, right?
Alas.
But she panned it. She didn't like it.
Yeah.
And then it turned out that Atwood found out years and years later that the person who had assigned the book to Mary McCarthy did not know that Mary McCarthy had recently had a stroke. So the review was a bit incoherent, is the word that she uses, but it was also, it must have been shattering, you know, this like a breakthrough book. But the Times makes mistakes. Reviewers have their limitations, right?
Present company accepted, of course.
Well, of course. And at least, you know, at least Margaret Atwood would be able to say, well, you know, poor Mary McCarthy wasn't very well at the time.
Well, so, yeah, that was nice of her.
So perhaps she doesn't have to take it too much to heart.
Right, and she didn't make the point that Mary McCarthy should only have lived to see what happened with this failure of a novel.
Well, exactly. I mean, nobody could have imagined that. I mean, the magnitude of success of this novel, and as you mentioned earlier, The Testaments, the follow-up book. So what are Atwood's own thoughts on this novel and its you know, its evolution and afterlife and continuing life? I mean, it must be strange to have one's work become so much a part of the atmosphere, as you put it, so, you know, so that people will refer to it without even knowing the work itself. She doesn't seem like the sort of person who'd let that get to her head.
No, I think she seems very level-headed. Maybe it's being from Canada, maybe it's having really worked hard for many, many, many years, that she knows that's what she has to keep doing, is keep working. And she obviously keeps abreast of all the developments and likes to see what they're doing with her work. And I hope I hope she put in a swimming pool or bought a nice big house and restored it or something. But because it always amazes me that once a writer has achieved that kind of renown and had movies made of her books and probably is financially set and doesn't have to write anymore to make a living, that she still writes. She still writes all the time. I think that's so admirable.
And I suppose you would hope as well that because she's written about how writers need to look after their backs, I hope she has put in a swimming pool.
Right. I've been onto that for a while. I do my back exercises as soon as I get up in the morning.
It's very good practical advice from Margaret Atwood. It's also, I think it's interesting, isn't it, that she is, as you say, there's not many writers who reach that level of recognition, and there's probably not that many older women who are listened to with that amount of attention. So I think it's thank goodness she is writing and, you know, reading everything and having opinions and giving talks and all of that, because she doesn't have to, as you say, Mary. No. Does she could just go and swim in her pool. But I think it's very good that she does, because she's pretty fearless, isn't she?
Yes, maybe that also is something that comes with age. She seems to me completely fearless. Right after I turned my review in, I discovered that the Times of New York had printed a review and citing some of the same sentences I cited, their reviewer gave it a pan. I don't know why they seem to like that, but it's not going to hurt her. You know, she's bigger than that critic, which is fabulous. I think it's fabulous.
I've seen her. I've seen her talk a number of times, and she seems to, I mean, this, people say this sort of thing all the time, but in her case, it's true. She really does seem to cast a spell over people. She, you know, she sniffs and the whole room is just, you could hear a pin fall.
I think if we were in a different age, she would be burned as a witch, you know, precisely because of that fearlessness.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's true.
That doesn't sound like a compliment, yeah. But I absolutely yeah. take it that it is.
It's meant as a compliment, right?
So tell us, Mary, about your own first time reading Atwood, because can you recall those first impressions?
Well, yes, I read years ago on the copy desk at the New Yorker. I was given a short story by her to copy edit. It was called Stone Mattress. Mm-hmm. And I was delighted to come upon the origins of that story in a very short essay in Burning Questions. It was not speculative fiction. It was a good old-fashioned murder mystery. Just a short piece and about a woman who, call her a serial widow, like the Black Widow, who is on a cruise in the Arctic and learns about these things, stromatolites, which are this formation of like pillowy looking stone. And it occurred to Margaret Atwood, I discovered in the book, that in Burning Questions in her essay that it occurred to her right away that one of those would make a wonderful murder weapon. And so she and her husband developed the story where a widow would get away with murder on a cruise ship where she, you know, leaves somebody behind who's been bashed over the head, I think. Anyway.
It sounds almost Agatha Christie-like.
Yeah, well, reading this, I saw in this story, very short piece, what a good storyteller she is, how she just works it all out. And, you know, I was quite enthralled with this story, and it did convert me. There are so many things to read, though, and she herself has produced so much.
And what one of the things that comes across in that story, I remember reading it again when it came out. And it's the wickedness, isn't it? There's a wickedness, a kind of glinting eyed wickedness.
Yes, mischief.
Yes.
Yes. That is one of the delights of her, I think. It's just so what's the word? It's kind of catching. Something contagious about the prose that it does draw you in, and you're in the writer's world.
So what writers and works by others feature here? Because she writes about her own work, but she also nods to or you know, engages deeply with some of the people who have influenced her, I think.
Well, one thing that she has been doing for years, I went out and got another book of hers, I confess. I went out and got another book of her nonfiction, because this is the third collection, big collection of nonfiction by her, and I wondered what else she'd written about. So I got hold of Second Words, which is her critical prose from 1960 to 1982. And you can see between 1982 and 2004, there was probably another book in there. But she has been a wonderful promoter of her fellow Canadians. She sees it as, I think, her mission to make Canada and writers from Canada more visible. So a lot of the writers that she writes about are her fellow Canadians. She has a wonderful piece in Burning Questions on Alice Munro. And, you know, I think it's very generous of her, because, you know, I am small-minded and catty and provincial and things. So I would have been jealous. I would have been very envious of Alice Munro if I were the other Canadian woman writer, you know, the one who didn't win the Nobel.
She's won so many other things.
But her essay on Alice Munro is just full of sisterhood and pride and generosity. And it's really wonderful.
Mm. The collection spans, as you said, 2004 to 2021, which was quite a chunk of time. And it's also, you know, in that time, she became famous in a way that such a small number of writers, especially living writers, does. Has that changed anything, do you think, in her tone, in the way that she talks about the work or conceives of it or thinks about her role as a writer?
Well, I don't think so. I think this habit she had of writing, of responding to commissions from early on, you know, just to make the money, that is something that I think has stuck with her and that she does very much the same way. And I think she still lends a hand to other writers. She's somebody who I think kind of tries to share the wealth in a way, rather than, you know, lock herself up with her millions. Yeah, she's on a level with Stephen King, right? Who is another of the writers that she writes about and whom she admires.
Mm. Well, I mean, she sounds like an all-round good thing. Which we suspected, I think, before you reviewed this collection for us, but you've confirmed it to us now, I think.
Oh, good. Well, I came to it open-minded, and I was not disappointed. You know, I had these few encounters with her in real life, and I count copy editing the story Stone Mattress, and I was very impressed with the range that she has in the collection of essays, you know, that she seems like willing to tackle anything. Mm.
And really willing to work, as I think we've probably made clear, she's a real worker. And you, one of the earliest encounters that you did have with her kind of gives us an image of that, doesn't it? Of her sitting at a table working. waiting and working and hoping.
Yes.
And just putting in the hours.
Yes. Well, you know, I think I got the impression from some of these pieces when she's on her way to give a talk, I did get the impression that she writes on airplanes. I read somewhere that she carries two pencils, an extra one in case the point on the first one wears down or breaks, and that she carries these pencils when she gets on an airplane. And I could really see her scribbling on the tabletop in her seat, deciding what she's going to tell these people when she gets there, you know, maybe getting a, getting, in fact, the outline of it by being very direct, saying, this is what I'm going to talk about at this thing, and then letting it come out.
Can you just paint a picture for us then on just a parting note there of the first time you saw her in the flesh? It was in a department store.
Oh, that picture of her in the department store when she was selling her very first book was called The Edible Woman. She described that at a book sales conference in Albuquerque, where she was speaking at a breakfast meeting to authors and sellers of books, independent booksellers mostly. And she just described her first publicity stunt, I guess you would call it, which was selling books, signing books in the men's underwear department of a Canadian department store in the West, I think, in Alberta. And she just sat there next to the escalator at a little table while the men came in looking, shopping for socks and jockey shorts. And the title, she said, scared them away, the title, The Edible Woman. And she did sell two books, but how brave. And at this conference, she was actually reminiscing with, I think, the person who either edited that first collection or who was her publicity person at the publisher who set that up for her, her very first professional appearance as a writer. So she had certainly come a long way.
That's very forgiving to still share a stage with the person who made you sit in the men's underwear department with your book, The Edible Woman, isn't it? I think we can add forgiving to her list of virtues.
So in a way, I suppose she always feels like she's in that men's underwear department.
Exactly. And I just think there's something so wonderful about now being able to picture her sitting in that men's underwear department by the escalator, waiting to sell those two books. And presumably at the end of the day, leaving feeling like she'd accomplished something. I hope she did. I'm sure she did. But to be able to picture that version of her alongside the one that we now know she is, where she can hush a room of thousands with a sneeze. So Mary Norris, thanks very much for bringing us Margaret Atwood then and Margaret Atwood now. Thanks for talking to us.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Still to come on the show, a journey to the so-called Spice Islands, about 2,500 miles and two time zones away from Jakarta, approaching Papua New Guinea, where in the shadow of a volcano, nutmeg trees once grew largely undisturbed by the rest of the world. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free, wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you will never miss an episode.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Lucy Dallas. Now, if I were to ask what a nutmeg has to do with the climate, indeed with the whole planet, you would be forgiven for perhaps drawing a blank. But Amitav Ghosh has linked them inextricably in his book, The Nutmeg's Curse, Parables for a Planet in Crisis. Our reviewer, Professor Sujit Sivasundaram, calls the book urgent, beautiful and far-reaching and says, The Nutmeg's Curse shows how the story of this fruit can stand for the world we inhabit and the plight it faces. And we're delighted that Sujit Sivasundaram is here to talk us through this today. Sujit, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation. It's great to be with you.
You begin your piece at the origin of all this by describing the fruit of the nutmeg tree, which we might think we're familiar with, but we're probably not, and telling us where the tree grows. Can you just walk us through those basics, please?
Sure. So what's interesting about the nutmeg fruit is that it's a composite. So it's got this outer fruit, which is just inside the skin, which is green or yellow in color, and then the core, which is webbed, and an interior seed, which is the nutmeg. So in a sense, it's not a singular fruit, it's a composite. And that's why it's interesting in terms of theorizing the planetary crisis, because arguably, even as we isolate it, it becomes many things in turn. And the way Amitav uses it is that Amitav Ghosh, the novelist who has now written this book of nonfiction, is as a symbol really for the whole planet. And so one can immediately think of how the different elements of the nutmeg equate to the different hemispheres, to the atmosphere, to the earth, the different elements really of our planet. And so it becomes a symbol, but also an entry point into the climate crisis in this book, The Nutmeg's Curse.
Mm-hmm. And where is it that the tree grows, and why did this lead to so many problems?
Yeah, sure. So it's a horrific story, really. Though it's such a beautiful fruit, it grew only in the Bandar Islands, the so-called Spice Islands, and the particular ecology of one island was critical to its growth. And so there was a race in the early modern period to seize this island amongst Europeans, and it was finally the Dutch who take control of the island, and a genocide then unfolds as they try to impose a monopoly over the production of the nutmeg. And in place of the indigenous peoples who are horrifically displaced from their ancestral home, the Dutch then bring in enslaved peoples to cultivate the nutmeg in the Bandar Islands. So in some ways, really, it comes from a particular place, but it is also a particular story of settlement, colonization and genocide, which then leads into its global travels as a commodity, and a precious commodity at that. It was highly valued by early modern Europeans. It was often equated to gold, and it was said to be more valuable than its weight in gold.
How long did that part of the history go on for? I mean, you know, what happened to the trade in nutmeg there after the Dutch had left? It was an earlier way of growing and working it re-established, or, you know, is such a return impossible?
The first thing to say is, of course, that there is an earlier trade in the nutmeg, which is Asian, which is connected to the Arab trade and to South Asians as well. So it's not the case that the Europeans can kind of create the trade in the nutmeg. Rather, it's the way there's a sort of transition from an Indian Ocean trading system, which is pre-existent, to a corporate monopoly through the Dutch East India Company, the VOC, which is the sort of significant change in terms of trading practice. And arguably, Amitav Ghosh's point more broadly about cultivation is that though Europeans impose plantation systems in various parts of the world, it isn't the case that these operate successfully without the help of local peoples, of indigenous peoples, of enslaved peoples. And so their knowledges are really critical to the story as well. So really, maybe from both those angles in relation to what existed prior, as also how the plantation system operates, it's not the case that Europeans are able to do it in their own terms or fully through their own initiative.
You say it's striking that the linking narrative, because the book begins, doesn't it, with the Banda Islands and with the awful, horrific events that happen there. You say it's striking that this linking narrative takes place there rather than, let's say, in the Americas, though Ghosh does also talk about the more familiar stories of the settlers in the US as well and their destruction of the Native American people and environment. Why did you find this choice of the Banda Islands so striking?
Yeah, so I'm a historian of the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean, and a lot of my work is targeted towards really taking stories that we know from the Atlantic context and retelling them from the vantage point of the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean. And so this is especially striking with what we know about enslavement, that we often think about the links between West Africa and the Caribbean and Britain, and we should do, and we need to think even more and more about those links, but we forget about the history of enslavement in the Indian Ocean. We forget about the plantation complex in the Indian Ocean. And one very significant argument in Amitav Ghosh's book is that the Indian Ocean is really vital to consider for the future of our planet, because so many people live facing the Indian Ocean. So many fossil fuels today travel, I think 70%, he says, of the fossil fuels that are traded travel through Indian Ocean trading routes. And this is a place where there are cities which are low-lying, and we could go on listing the reasons for why it's significant like this. It's right at the heart, really, of geopolitical challenges between India and China. Might be another way to argue for its centrality. So we really need to think through the roots of our present predicament in relation to the climate crisis, in relation to the legacies of empire, in relation to how we think through race and so forth via the Indian Ocean as well, not to displace the Atlantic story, but rather to think with these sites as well.
Mm-hmm. And I think, was it also because what he found was that the stories, well, all these stories of European settlement and displacement and destruction of people, they had a sort of similar mindset, and this new type of colonialism thought very differently about land and the environment, had a very different worldview at odds with the indigenous people who actually lived on the lands that the settlers were taking over. And that was crucial, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is one of the key contributions of the book, to really encourage us to think about storytelling and even singing about nature. So if we think about indigenous cosmologies of nature, indigenous worldviews of nature, Amitav Ghosh reminds us that they're vitalist and animated. So whereas European colonization muted nature and muted indigenous peoples, indigenous perspectives were far more complicated. And so if we are to think our way through the climate crisis, we need to return to storytelling, we need to return to chants, we need to return to a more connected view of our relationship with nature. And so we need to return to the Banda Islands, amongst many other sites, including in the Atlantic, including in Mauritius, which he writes about as well, including in other island societies in the Global South, where this transformation of nature to muted plantations was occurring with the rise of capitalist orders. So I think, yeah, just the sort of point that storytelling and a reimagination of nature is critical for us, because I guess sometimes with the debate about the climate emergency, we can be swallowed by facts and data and statistics. And arguably, this is a sort of invitation to do something different, to think with stories and to think through how indigenous storytelling can actually be so powerful as we face this future ahead of us.
So I suppose with that sort of approach in mind, what can you tell us about the tone of the work? I mean, I suppose it would be easy for a book so steeped in, as you say, in in the history and politics and climate awareness to come across as either dry or dense or doom laden. But perhaps with this emphasis on storytelling, how does that allow Ghosh to pitch himself to come to us?
Well, I couldn't put this book down, to be honest with you. It's beautifully written. And of course, we know that the fiction that he writes is beautifully written. And he has successfully transitioned he's sort of moved his style from fiction to nonfiction, which is quite difficult. It could have gone wrong. It's meditative. So I guess the point here about the nutmeg standing for the earth itself is that it moves from big to small. So it moves from a particular island to a larger tale about genocide leading into ecocide and so forth. So I guess it sort of jumps across scales well as a story. It moves across different crises, the migrant crisis, the crisis in relation to fuel, and across periods as well. So I think, yeah, it's certainly well written, but the strength lies in the way he moves between scales and how he uses the symbolic power of particular elements, natural elements like the nutmeg, to stand for larger stories. And that's in keeping really with indigenous cosmology itself and the way indigenous peoples think about nature. So it's fitting in relation to the broader art.
He's telling stories as well, isn't he? He tells, he gives little vignettes about what's happening to him in the pandemic and what's happening to other people. And also he makes the story of the Banda Islands a narrative. You know, it becomes a story, doesn't it? It's not just a sort of, these are the facts and this is what happens. He kind of speculates and digresses. It's very involving, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, that is the sort of other side of it, which we could critique in the sense that maybe there are a lot of digressions. And so the jumps between the climate crisis and the migrant crisis and between the early modern and the modern come quickly. But I think we do need works like this that experiment and that jump genres and that move across contexts, rather than work simply on the plantation complex in the Indian Ocean or the migrant crisis in the Mediterranean. Because I think the fundamental logic is that there is a sort of hidden connection between all of this, which is the environment and is the silencing of another way of engaging with nature.
Mm. He also, in fact, he borrows a term from science fiction, doesn't he? He talks about terraforming, on Earth, which might initially seem a bit odd, but actually it makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
Absolutely. So the management of landscapes for plantations. And I suppose, so one aspect of this is certainly the agency and continuing power of indigenous storytelling. Another aspect of this is the power of nature and the agency of nature. So the argument runs a bit like this, that there is all this terraforming, the building of infrastructure, the controlling of nature through programs of urbanization and so forth, as we know. But in Amitav Ghosh's view, the climate emergency now sees nature shrugging terraforming off, as it were, or in a sense escaping from the terraforming. So whereas humans have tried to silence nature, to manipulate nature, to control nature through terraforming as well, now we're at a point where actually nature's power is manifest once again, and human limitation is evident in episodes of disaster and so forth in our world. And so it really is sort of insistence on the power of nature as well as the power of indigenous peoples.
Yeah, it kind of works both ways, though, doesn't it? Because it's in the early modern times, it was you know, when they were trying to get rid of all the nutmeg trees and all that, that was actually just very difficult for them because they had to contend with the realities of the land they were on, which they didn't know very well. But what's happening now is precisely because the humans have made such great incursions. So it's very much it's because of that, as it were, that bit's not a natural process.
No, yeah, I think it's the sort of arc, isn't it, that we've gone through these companies that were at the heart of early modern imperialism, the Dutch East India Company, but also the English East India Company. And those corporate entities have been tied up with capitalist orders, with global exchanges, the Bandar Islands being swapped for New York, for instance, as I mentioned in the review at one point, and then into modes of standardization, which were central to the modern world, where cities are built on templates across the world, or where agricultural knowledge is shared. And so now we're at the end of that arc, really, from early modern corporations via modern states and their management of nature, and on to the climate emergency.
Mm-hmm. And in a funny sort of way, he talks in some detail. The detail is horrible, but you have to hear about it. He talks about how the settlers, I'm thinking about more in the US now, about how they got rid of a lot of the Native Americans. In a funny sort of way, their methods were aimed at the land and the animals. They were aware of them, weren't they, as well as the people. He makes the argument that it wasn't like war, wasn't a war on those tribes, because men and women and children and animals and the land itself were attacked on every front. They destroyed the buffalo that they needed. They introduced smallpox. They flooded the land. And as I said, they even tried to, didn't the Dutch try and get rid of all the nutmeg trees that went under their control?
Absolutely. Yes, this is very much in keeping with the way the Dutch operated monopolies elsewhere. I've been interested in cinnamon in Sri Lanka, for instance, where again, they got rid of all the cinnamon trees which were not under their monopoly. And you're absolutely right. I think the phrase that comes to mind, which is under debate quite heavily in the humanities at the moment, of racial capitalism, where humans are converted into stock, effectively, right next to animals, right next to land. And so it's really the kind of complex of the human and the non-human, which has been managed by these capitalist orders, which is significant. And I would argue, and I have done this elsewhere, is that the idea of race itself is fundamentally also about the distinction between the human and the animal, because as these Europeans arbitrating, you know, what is an animal and what is a human, they're also arbitrating the difference between different human orders or human beings, as they say it. And so it's important to kind of think about the environmental context to the idea of race, and also how the management of humans and land and animals was all one part of the same program of racial capitalism.
Mm-hmm. And in an odd sort of way, the problem was in a way human exceptionalism. You say that the thinking that we've talked about it recently on the podcast a bit, the idea that nature with a capital N is over there, humanity is not part of it, and it's a resource, so you use it, and nature includes all plants, all animals, all of that. You use it as a resource, whereas back to the vitalist view, which he talks about, a more than human perspective, which he thinks is crucial to restore some balance.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's out there includes non-white peoples as well as land and nature. And that's all under capital N nature, by the way. And so what we need is to undo the distinction there at the heart of racial capitalism, so that we include a kind of distribution of agency right across that complex of human, non-human, people of color, colonized people, et cetera, and then in turn actually sort of attend to the way knowledge works from a different perspective, which is outside that European order, which is the indigenous order. So I guess to undo racial capitalism, one needs both those steps, really, of dismantling this divide of the human and the non-human, but also starting with indigenous perspectives in turn.
Finally, do you think that's what it's a sort of call to do that, the book, or is it more just a laying out of this is how we got here? Does it have a, I don't want to say message, that makes it sound preachy, it's not preachy at all, but does it have a sort of call to arms, do you think?
Yeah, it does, I think. I mean, he has written it in the midst of the pandemic, and he writes about this in the book as well, and also with Black Lives Matter on the streets outside his apartment, I think. And so it is a call to arms. I think it's an urgent book, and it is really important that we read books like this. There are various challenges which face us at the moment, but the climate emergency hasn't gone away.
Mm-hmm. Sujit, many, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
that is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Mary Norris and Sujit Sivasundaram. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Sophia Franklin. We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.